it's soaking up a little bit. But anyway, it's been good. It's probably not a good idea to start a talk by doing something that's potentially embarrassing to your host. But I have to, this is, just to let you know, so my host won't be totally embarrassed. This is the only philosophy book I've been carrying around. But I have to start, I just can't resist this quote on the bottom of page 14, it's footnote 14, a claim that they endorse. Of course, as Gleemore mentions, metaphysicians usually also use logic and set theory to formulate their theories. From our perspective, this does not confer any extra epistemic status on their activity, but it may bamboozle the outsider on the student into, or the student into supposing the activity has much in common with mathematics and science. So if the verb is bamboozle for metaphysicians of that ilk, I worry what he's going to say for people who do this on a Sunday morning at 9:30. Okay, so today I'm going to be talking about mathematical structuralism, anti-Rem mathematical structuralism. And there are a set of issues that come up if you read the literature time and time again. And the people that that work in this field, they then develop arguments to come down one side or the other of all these issues. But what Uri and I would like to do is show that each of these issues can be resolved on a theoretical basis by starting with a group of principles that then have as theorems claims that decide these issues, so that we're not blown in the wind one way or the other depending on how the mood takes us or how our theory has developed so far, but there's a principled way of answering the questions. And in some cases, if they square with intuitions, that's good. If not, well, we have to explore the intuitions and to see whether there are other theories that preserve them. So the particular issues I'm going to be talking about are these. In what precise sense is mathematics about abstract structure? In what precise sense are the elements of a structure incomplete? What are the essential properties of the elements of a structure? Can there be identity and distinctness between elements of different structures? For example, is the natural 2 the same as the natural number 2, the same as the number 2 of piano number theory? And are these identical to the number 2 of real number theory? And does the answer suffer from the Julius Caesar problem? Do the elements of a mathematical structure ontologically depend on the structure? Do the elements of a structure have x80s? And is indiscernibility a problem for structuralism? So I hope to develop a set of principles that and identify what a structure is and what the elements of a structure are that predicts answers to these questions in the form of theorems. And by the way, I'm going to be talking about mathematical theories in general and not just applied mathematical theories. So I'm interested in the ones that might be applied in some either future science or some possible scientific theory. So the way I'm going to go about doing this is to first review, for those of you who haven't seen it before, and I apologize to those who have, but I suspect that, and it just seems to be a fact that where I go, it's a good thing to explain these principles again, the axiomatic theory of abstract objects that I've been developing. And I'm going to show how mathematics is then analyzed within that theory, and then interpret the analysis as a form of structuralism. And then we're going to revisit each issue in light of this theory and analysis to show how the theory addresses the issue. And as we tackle the issues, we're going to find out some more facts about the theory, the technical details that I just did, that I had to suppress in a brief presentation. And then we're going to compare it to some of the other forms of structuralism. That's the project. Now, the good news for those of you who've seen the theory of abstract objects before is I've compressed it down to 2 slides. The bad news for those of you who haven't seen it before is it's a compressed presentation. Let me tell you, I'm going to put all of the primitive notions I'm going to use up front on the table. And here's what I'm going to start with. I'm going to start with n-place relations and variables ranging over them, n greater than or equal to 0. So in the case of a one-place relation, it's going to be called a property. A zero-place relation will be called a proposition. And I want you to think of these things intentionally, not as functions, not as sets of worlds, not as functions from worlds to sets, whatever. Think of them as intentionally. Use your intuitions of what properties and relations are. And I'll take the notion, I haven't told you which ones exist yet, but I will. I just want you to use the notion as primitive. And I'm going to use the notion of an object or an individual, something that's not predicable. And I haven't told you what those things are like, I haven't told you what exists, I'm just using that notion as primitive. Then I'm going to use negation, conditionals, the quantifier, and the backwards, the defined quantifier. That's going to be a univocal notion of existence. And then I'll use a modal operator. And I'll use two term-forming operators, the lambda for being such that, and the iota for the. And then one distinguished predicate, e bang, to mean concrete. And I'm not going to define what concrete is. I'm just going to let you take it as a primitive notion. It doesn't matter whether you use concrete. You can use any primitive notion you like that somehow makes these axioms true. Okay? So those are my primitives. So with those primitives, take a second order, and I should put that in quotes because it's not going to be full second order logic, it's going to be weak second order logic under generalized Hankin models, so you really don't have full second order logic there. But the natural way to state the theory is with second-order logic, so I'm going to pretend like we're in second-order logic. Take a second-order quantified S5 modal logic with Barkan formulas for both the individuals and the properties and relations. So you have fixed domains, no Kripke structures. Things don't go in and out of existence from world to world. Just one domain. Your quantifier reaches over everything. It's not enfeebled to range only over the things that exist in our world, right? It ranges over everything whatsoever. Except instead, and it's in addition to the usual atomic formula x1 through xn instantiate or stand in the relation f, which we all know and which I don't want to abandon, and in fact because Frege and Russell showed us how this notion suffices plus standard classical logic suffices for the analysis of mathematical statements, I want to add one new primitive, and I call it X encodes F. And for those of you who haven't seen this before, I'm not going to spend a lot of time motivating it, but here's the basic idea. With things, ordinary objects, you know, tables and chairs, people, planets, whatever, they're out there in some manifold, and or they're given an experience somehow. And if you want to find out what their properties are, you have to go over there and investigate. You have to do some work in order to find out what their properties are. But abstract objects are not like that. I don't take them to be out there, supernatural things outside of the causal order, waiting to be discovered. So I'm not a Platonist in that sense. But I think that abstract objects are precisely the way we conceive them to be according to our best theories. And so if you've got a theory of your favorite abstract object, you're going to have to tell me what properties it's got. And this theory is then going to say that there's an object that meets your description that encodes those properties, but doesn't necessarily exemplify those properties. So you might even tell me an inconsistent theory or an incomplete theory. And there will be objects that encode the properties that you specify, but those objects might be incomplete, or they might be inconsistent, or in some cases, you can actually specify abstract objects that are complete and consistent. So there's all sorts of things in there. But the main thing is that you don't get contradictions if you end up inadvertently specifying inconsistent properties. All you get is that the object encodes the property and encodes its negation, especially if you think it's logically closed. Then with this distinguished predicate and lambda expressions and rigid definite descriptions, I'm going to define ordinary objects as a kind of thing that might be concrete, and an abstract object is not the kind of thing that could be concrete. And the intuition here is that things like the number one, they're not the kind of thing that could be concrete. That's some notion of abstractness. I hope that it's clear enough for us to get moving and do some work, because we're going to now axiomatize abstractness and encoding in some formulas. But before I do, I want to tell you what identity is not a primitive, but it's going to be defined, completely general. And the definition says x equals y, whatever x and y are, just in case either they're both ordinary objects and they necessarily exemplify the same properties. This is the Leibnizian version. Or they're both abstract and they both necessarily encode the same properties. Okay? So there's a kind of Leibnizian law for abstract objects, that is, they're going to be identified when they encode. Now, of course, abstract objects exemplify properties too. They're going to be complete with respect to the properties they exemplify, even though they might be incomplete with respect to the properties that they encode. But what their encoded properties are the ones that are by which we're going to individuate them and identify them. And in addition to defining identity for individuals, we have identity for properties, propositions, and relations in general. But that one's too many chicken scratches, so I'll just tell you what that is. This definition, two properties are identical, just in case, the hand up there, just in case they're necessarily encoded by the same objects. Notice that this doesn't say they're identical just in case they're necessarily exemplified by the same objects. There you could give good counterexamples to. You all can pick up your favorite necessarily true properties that are distinct but necessarily exemplified in all the same worlds by the same objects. And so that would falsify that definition. But the point is here, if you really do have two distinct properties, then you can conceive of the pure object that encodes the one without encoding the other, and vice versa. That's what this is telling us. And propositions are going to be defined in terms of these Cambridge-type properties, being a Y such that P, being a Y such that Obama is president, for example, which everything has because Obama is president, right? And so I'll say that this definition, by the way, traces back to, I discovered from Tony Anderson, goes back to Mahill, who suggested in 1951 in a paper that not many people read anymore, but it's there. Basically, the properties you can construct out of those propositions, if they're identical, then the propositions are identical. And then we'll use, as part of our logic, beta, eta, and alpha conversion on lambda expressions. Those are the computer science terms. You all know them as lambda conversion, and you can variables don't make a difference to the lambda formula, and if you have an elementary lambda formula, it denotes the same thing as the head relation. And we'll use the Russell axiom to axiomatize definite descriptions. Okay, so now we're going to get moved. Notice that from beta conversion, so what's an example of beta conversion, in case you haven't seen that before? Okay, so here's an example. An example might be, being an x such that x is not round, y exemplifies that if and only if it's not the case that y is round. Okay, that's a simple instance of lambda conversion. And by the way, I should mention, since Shamik was talking about this yesterday, these lambda expressions can be given denotations in an algebraic structure of the kind he was describing yesterday. So for example, if the algebraic structure has a negation operator that takes properties to their negations, then the denotation of that lambda expression would denote that structure property, okay, the complex property. And so anyway, so from this, from lambda conversion, you can derive a second order comprehension principle for properties and relations. And by the way, I should mention one thing here. Phi in lambda expressions cannot have encoding formulas. The only formulas you can have are the first and second order definable formulas that you get from standard exemplification logic. So you can have quantifiers, modal operators, it can be vacuously bound lambda expressions, conjunctions, disjunctions, all huge complex algebra of properties and propositions, but no new properties that are made with encoding formulas. Now, from this, you can derive this. Why? Well, you can universally generalize on these variables, then use the rule of necessitation, and then since this is a term, existentially generalize on this term to get this principle. I've switched the variables there, sorry. Should be y1 through yn. And then you get existence claims. no matter what formula phi you put over there, that has no free f's and no free encoding and no encoding formula. So you'll get that every property g, there's something which is its negation, right? It'll follow from this that there is a f such that necessarily for all x, fx, if and only if it's not the case of gx, and then that holds for every property g. Okay. So it's a rather rich theory of properties and relations and propositions. And then there's two basic axioms for abstract objects. Well, actually three, and one I didn't put on the slide. One is that encoding is rigid. If it's possible that X encodes a property F, then it's necessary that X encodes F. That is, encoding is not relative to any circumstance. Once an abstract object encodes a property in some world, it encodes that property in every world. But then there's this principle that says that ordinary objects necessarily fail to encode properties. This is a principle I'm not actually committed to, in the sense that there may be ways to apply the theory in which you relax this constraint, and maybe I'll say more about that later. But for now, it keeps things very simple. The only things that are going to encode properties are abstract objects. And the main comprehension principle for abstract objects says, whenever you've got a formula phi that has possibly a free variable f but no free x's, then there's an abstract object that encodes exactly the properties f satisfying phi. What's an example? Well, let B here be some object, let's say Bertrand-Russell, and f here is a free variable. So this is an instance of this schema. It says there's an abstract object that encodes exactly the properties that Russell exemplifies. A perfect little model of Russell in our abstract space. You might, if you were Leibnizian, you might say it's a complete concept that contains, by way of encoding, all the things that are that apply, all the properties that apply to Russell. Now from this, and we're going to see lots of instances of this comprehension schema later, but for now, in the presence of that definition of identity for abstract objects, there could be two distinct abstract objects that encode exactly the property satisfying phi, because distinct abstract objects have to differ by one of their encoded properties. So every one of these instances gives us a unique abstract object that encodes exactly the property satisfying phi, which means that definite descriptions of this form become canonical and always well-defined, no matter what phi you put in there. You can stick in any formula phi, it doesn't have any free x's, and you've got a well-defined definite description. And it follows, governing those definite descriptions, that such an object encodes a property g just in case g satisfies phi. What's an example of this? Well, Russell, the abstract object that encodes exactly the properties that Russell exemplifies, encodes the property of being a logician, if and only if Russell's a logician. Okay. Seems almost analytic, right? I hope you agree. It sounds almost analytic. Okay, those are the two slides on object theory. And just to convince you I'm not trying to bamboozle you, I want to stop here and take questions and sacrifice some of my time to make sure everybody understands. So if there's something that's not yet clear, please raise your hand and I'll see if I can address it. Yes?
You said it more about encoding.
Yeah, sure. So it's come up in the history of philosophy several ways. It's come up in Plato. If you read one of the former graduate students at Princeton, Constance Meinwald, who studied with Michael Frege, she made a study of the Parmenides and concluded that Plato was trying to show in the Parmenides that there are two kinds of ways an object can have a property. X can have f in one way, if x is an ordinary object, and if x is a form, it'll have f in a different way. There's a Greek name for these, and I won't bore you with the details. But the idea is that forms have their properties, the defining property f, the form of f, has f in a way that's different from the way ordinary f things have f. So it comes up in Plato. It's come up in Boulos' analysis of Frege, who says that Frege used two instantiation relations to say that the number one falls under the concept, that's falls under the concept being identical to number one, but that the concept being identical to the number one is in the number one, because number one is a higher order extension of first order concepts, all the one element concepts. So there's two kind of relations there between objects and concepts. Kripke, in his unpublished Locke lecture, says that there's a confusing, look at lecture 13, number three, it says, there's a confusing double usage of predication in fiction, which we'll get into if we don't be, if we're not careful. So he says, an example is Hamlet is melancholy versus Hamlet was admired by many critics. So in my view, and Kripke doesn't regiment the distinction, but what I would do, what I have done, is regiment it as follows. Holmes's encoded properties, or Hamlet's encoded properties, are the ones attributed to him in the novels. His exemplified properties, like being, are things like being admired by many critics. Now, but originally, I got this from Ernst Malley, who was a, held a chair in Graz after Meinong did, and saved Meinong's naive theory of objects from Russell's objection by postulating two kinds of, he says, there are abstract objects that are determined by properties without in turn satisfying them. So that's all I can say at this point.
Are you saying that there are two different relations, so two different primitives, differentiation and encoding? You can't define one in terms of the other. So two primitive ways
of being F. So that X is F becomes ambiguous.
So if we don't get what encoding is, what do we do?
Well, here's what you do. If I'm a student in math class and I say, I don't get X is a member of Y, what do I do? Well, too bad. You just learn the axioms and learn how to work with it, right?
So you want to define encoding by the formalization?
If I can't define it, the best thing I can do for you, the best anybody can do for you, is axiomatize it. And you learn the axioms, you learn what the theorems say, you
but
learn...
So if you have a perfect logic, so well, I can't give you any deep account, but we, I can give you examples.
I gave examples. Holmes is a detective. Is ambiguous. A true reading means it encodes. He encodes being a detective. A false reading is to say he exemplifies being a detective, because if you exemplify being a detective, it'd be concrete. And he's not concrete. So I can give you examples like that, but that sound like that's persuading you. Is it not persuading you?
Well, I mean, in terms of instantiation, some kind of special kind of instantiation.
Look, even Lewis in the beginning of Truth and Fiction says, is there not some perfectly well-defined, this is a quote, is there not some perfectly well-defined sense of is in which Holmes is a detective?
But Lewis was a realist about, he was a modal realist. So
I'm a realist too.
Well, okay, so then he's got his kind of instantiation, that kind of instantiation that Lewis was talking about, just like the instantiation in this world, it's just that this world from our perspective has to be actual. But you have a distinct...
I'm saying there is a sense of is, and I want you to try to grasp that sense of is.
Okay.
In which Holmes is a detective.
Just heuristically then, Ed, can we grasp it in the way that I think Laurie is kind of trying to push us towards, that there's a get from the metaphysicians, a thin sense of instantiation, which doesn't commit you to thick and, say, concrete objects. There's a thin sense of instantiation which fictional objects can instantiate properly. At least for heuristic purposes, until we...
Let me try.
No, okay,
if that helps, fine. But that's really not what's going on.
Yeah, so
what's really going on here is, look, consider your mental image of Gorbachev. That image has a content. The content really does have characterized by the property of having a birthmark on his right temple. If that property didn't characterize the content of that image, it'd be a different image, right? The property characterizes the content in some deep way of your mental image. Got it? Are you with me so far?
I'm not old.
Okay. Well, I would say that property doesn't, the content of the image doesn't exemplify the property. Gorbachev exemplifies the property. But the content, I would say, encodes it. It's the thing that we need to show the directedness of our mental states toward things in the world that exemplify those properties. By the mental states are, when we perceive, whenever things, they're characterized by encoded properties, not the exemplified properties. If that doesn't do it, I don't know what's going to do it. I mean, at this point, you're just going to have to...
It's not a rejection, I just think you want
to... Yeah, well,
it's primitive.
Yeah, it's... A mathematician probably... Look, a mathematician, when he tells you what membership is, he gives you, you know, societies and groups and stuff like this, but he says, but that doesn't really work because the members of the group can change and yet the set stays the same, or the group stays the same, the set changes. But they all break down eventually. What you have to do is grab it by the horns and go with it, you know? Okay, yes.
Do you have relative second-order comprehension?
Yes, second-order comprehension. Of properties, right?
Yeah, so one way was the property of being encoding relation R and not falling under R.
That will lead to paradox, and that's why I don't allow encoding formulas in phi on the right-hand side.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, good point. Okay, all right, so I might extend the talk by 5 minutes. Okay. So now let me tell you how you analyze mathematics. So I think to really get a hold of mathematics, there's an intuitive division in mathematics between natural mathematics and theoretical mathematics, where natural mathematics is the things we ordinarily say about these pre-theoretic mathematical things like numbers and classes and triangles and stuff like that. We say things like the triangle has three sides, the number of planets is 8, there are more individuals in the class of insects than in the class of humans, etc., etc. On the other hand, we have theoretical mathematics, where mathematicians start deriving claims in the context of some explicit or even implicit, formal or informal, theories. Once you start proving theorems, you're doing theoretical mathematics. And because your theorems have got to come from some principles. You have to find that they all trace back to the axioms. And these are classic examples. But now what's going to happen is that object theory treats these two forms of mathematics differently. The natural mathematics we get for free right out of the axioms of object theory that we've got so far. The natural mathematics we're going to have to import into the theory under the scope of the theory operator, so that you import analytic truths of the form in ZF. The null set is an element of the unit set of ZF. Those are going to be treated as analytic truths that you get to import to extend object theory, okay? So we'll see how that goes. Then natural mathematics, I'll just go through these quickly. Here's some examples. The triangle, or the form of the triangle. It's the thing that encodes all the properties necessarily implied by being a triangle. Everybody see why that says that? Necessarily, for all y, if y is a triangle, y has f. That identifies all the properties implied by being a triangle. This says that there's an object that encodes all those. Okay, that's your intuitive concept of the triangle, the fat concept. The thin concept might be just encodes being a triangle, that's it. There is such an object, but I doubt it's probably what you have in mind when you think of a triangle. The number of g's, the abstract object that encodes exactly the properties f, which are in one-to-one correspondence with the g's. And now it turns out you have to modify that just a little bit to do this on the ordinary G's, and you get a version of Hume's principle, not strong enough to derive all the Dedekind piano axioms for number theory without a modal claim. But anyway, it's close enough, and there's a paper I wrote on this that shows how you can get out those axioms from this definition. You also get a version of basic law 5 by defining the extension of G as the abstract object that encodes exactly the properties materially equivalent to G. And you get basic law 5, but not in its full generality, because when you define membership, Y as a member of X, you use an encoding formula. And that won't allow you to create a new property or relation that generates the paradox. And then you get directions, and this is all developed in other work. And I forgot the bibliography at the end, so if you're interested, send me an email and I'll tell you what those are. You can probably look them up. Theoretical mathematics now. We're going to now do something completely different. We're going to treat theoretical mathematical objects and theoretical mathematical relations as creatures of a theory. And here's how we do it. First, I define P is true in theory T. So a proposition is going to be true in a theory, just in case that the theory encodes being such that P. Okay? So you take the proposition, turn it into a property being such that P, and whenever I'm treating theories now as abstract objects that encode propositional properties of this form. And so to say that P is true in T, or T makes P true, or in T, P holds, is to say that T encodes that property. Now for each one, this now just focus on mathematical objects in singular terms. For each formula phi that's an axiom or theorem of T, add to object theory the analytic truth that phi star is true in T, where phi star is the result of replacing every well-defined singular term kappa in phi by an indexed version of kappa, kappa sub T. So you just bring in all the truth of your favorite theory into object theory under the scope of the theory operator. And this is going to, of course, validate the rule of closure in the sense that whenever Q's are derived from P1 through Pn, and these are all truths in the theory, then Q is true in the theory. And from this, you can now give a theoretical identification of any singular term, what that term denotes for any arbitrary theory T. Namely, kappas of T, the object kappa in theory T is the abstract object that encodes exactly the properties F that hold of kappa in T. That is an incomplete object. It encodes only mathematical properties. And examples here are the zero of piano number theory, the null set of ZF, same form. Right? This is not a definition. It would be a bad definition because kappa sub T occurs on both sides. This is a principle you use once in the face, and it gives you an identity of this thing in the presence of judgments of this form that I take it constitute the data. The mathematicians make judgments of this form, and this theory kappa has this property. Right? And then you get this object. Well, not then. It's all just defined all at once. You bring all these in at once, this gets identified. And it follows that kappa encodes F if and only if it exemplifies F. Now, we're going to do the very, let's analyze some mathematical language here. So, by mathematical practice, and we're now just ignoring the relations at this point, in mathematical practice, you will see that in this theory, ZF, you can derive these claims. And here, I've abstracted using lambda abstraction on these claims, right? So, in ZF, you can prove that that the null set is an element of the unit set of the null set. And moreover, in ZF, you can derive that the null set exemplifies the property of being a set X, which is an element of the unit set of the null set. And the same for things here. Now, by importation, this now becomes analytic truths of object theory. That in ZF, this proposition here is true, because it encodes being such that that proposition is true. And it encodes this proposition is true. Notice on this side, it encodes a proposition where that thing has a property. So by the equivalence theorem, we can conclude that since the null set of ZF encodes F if and only if it exemplifies F in ZF, we can conclude from this that it encodes being such that it's an element of the unit set of the null set. So those are the kinds of properties that we know the null set encodes. And since encoding is a mode of predication, this gives me a true reading of the null set is an element of the unit set of the null set, the things that have relations. Now, of course, there's a false reading too, the exemplification reading. But the interesting thing is this now explains why the philosophers of mathematics can't even agree on the data. Hartree Fields and the fictionalists say the data is all the mathematics say, what the mathematicians say is just false. It could be good, even though it's false, it could be useful. Platonists, the structuralists, everybody else, they say it's just true. Why do they disagree on the data? Well, if there's an ambiguity in natural language, that one reading verifies what Hartree and the fictionalists say, the other reading verifies what the Platonists and the structuralists say. And the same goes with this other example. Now, the same kind of thing happens with mathematical relations. And I'll go through this quickly. You don't need full type theory, but this is a simple way of doing it. All you need is really third order. You need to go up one level. But suppose you've got a type theory where I is the type for individuals, and brackets T1 through TN, closed brackets, is the type of relations among entities with types T1 through TN. Then you can type this comprehension scheme so that in every type, so if you go up to the type of properties, it bifurcates into ordinary properties and abstract properties. the ordinary properties don't encode properties of properties, but the abstract properties will encode properties of properties, just like abstract individuals encode properties of individuals. The same for relations, or same for relations of relations. So it all just bifurcates, it branches into this nice structure, if you have a taste for such things. All you can do is, now, here's a simple example. Let R be a variable of the type relation between individuals. So that might be the membership relation, for example. And F be a variable of type properties of relations between individuals. Then this is an abstract, a comprehension principle says that there's an abstract relation which encodes just those properties of relations that satisfy phi. So now import for each axiom or theorem of T, not only that T makes phi star true, but where phi star is not only the result of replacing every well-defined singular term by its index version, but by every predicate by its index version. So that membership gets indexed to ZF or to ZFC, or successor gets indexed to piano number theory. Then this reduction axiom now tells us what those relations are. Very few philosophers of mathematics tell you what mathematical relations are. They know they're somehow incomplete, but the Platonists think that they're out there waiting to be discovered and axiomatized properly. I don't think that's the case. I think they're the way we conceive them to be by our best theories. And each theory that postulates different properties of that relation, you have a different abstract relation. So anyway, that's how I analyze mathematics using object theory. Now we're going to turn to the principles of those issues that we talked about at the beginning. But again, before I go on, this is a natural stopping point. Is there any question about how I actually apply the theory to mathematics? Yes?
You're treating mathematical theories as objects. I'm just wondering about how you capture the interrelationships between mathematical theories themselves.
What relationships do you have in mind?
Just thinking of the way in which you can embed certain mathematical structures in other mathematical structures.
Well, we haven't talked about structures yet.
That's my fault. So, think about ways...
Sub-theories, and you...
Sub-theories, there you go.
Yeah,
that can be made relate to other...
Yeah, we can talk about them. The sub-theories, depending on the strength of those sub-theories, might or might not be different from the original theories. We'll see. There's a way to talk about those. I'm going to have a slide on this in a little bit. But it's going to be with respect to structure, so that'll really address your question.
Independent of the structure question, if you think of mathematical theories as objects, how does the relationship between theories...
You can define relations between those objects.
Right.
Objects can stand in relations.
Well...
What the theory's about, objects and relations, and the relations are basic too. So you can define things between what's true and the theory.
You said something really interesting that I didn't quite catch about ambiguity that might explain differences between relations.
I was saying that this explains why the philosophers of mathematics can't even agree on the data. Some think that the data, that the statements of that mathematicians make are true. Some think that they're just false. I mean, if they can't even agree on what the data is to be explained, then they're going to be talking past each other when they give their theories about the philosophy of mathematics. Really. What I take it, the data is a set of true statements, and you're trying to give an analysis of those true statements. But the fictionists say, no, they're not true. And here's a reading in which they failed. There's also a reading in which they're true.
What was that one of those two readings?
Well, in the case that I gave, the null set is an element of the unit set of a null set. You read is as encodes, it's true. You read is as exemplifies, it's false. Okay, so how is mathematics about abstract structure? Well, when we extend the language of object theory by importing the expressions of the theorems of T into object theory, T's content becomes objectified. And so I then say the structure T is this abstract object that encodes exactly the propositions P which are true in T. Okay? And now, given what's expressed by T makes P true, T is an object that makes true all of the theorems of T. So that's what a structure does. So structures are abstract objects. Moreover, I'm going to define an element of a structure T to be such that T makes it the case that for anything Y distinct from that object X, which is an element, there's a property that distinguishes them. And the same for R as a relation of a structure. Of a structure T, just in case T makes it the case that for any other relation R, there's a property that properties of relations that R has and S doesn't. So the relations and elements of a structure are abstract. So we'll be able to talk about physical systems K have the structure T, just in case the relations of K exemplify the properties encoded by the relations of T, or in some cases if there's an isomorphism between the relations and objects of K and T. So that's the first question. How is mathematics about abstract structure? How are structural elements and relations implicated? Answer, yes, with respect to encoding, but not with respect to exemplification. So let's define X as incomplete, where no matter X is an individual or a property or whatever, just in case that there's a property at the right level that it fails to encode, and it fails to encode the negation of that property. Well, then we have it follows, as a theorem, we've got incomplete objects and incomplete relations. So yes, they are incomplete in one sense and complete in another. So the slogan, mathematical objects possess only structural relational properties, has two readings, one of which is true and one of which is false. Benacerra's argument from 1965, and it actually goes back to Russell, and I learned from reading Leighton's book, that Russell used it against Dedekind. Benacerra said that from the fact that numbers have no properties other than their structural ones, he concluded that numbers aren't objects. Because how can you have incomplete objects? I mean, according to the laws of logic, for every property F, either X has F or X has the negation of F. So how do you have incomplete objects? So you can't define things which are just defined or not only their mathematical properties. Of course, that fails when you've got objects that have both encoding and exemplified properties. And it undermines the examples that Shapiro gave and Lindeboe gave about these incomplete objects. For example, they both used examples like 3 has the property of being the number of my children and being my favorite number and being abstract. Those are things that exemplify, as opposed to, in some cases, and actually this can actually be given a different analysis as well, but I'll pass on that. Anyway, retreat from full and completeness isn't justified. Third issue, which properties are essential to structural elements? Answer, they're encoded properties. Why? Because these are the properties by which they're theoretically identified by the reduction axiom and by which they're individuated by the definition of identity for abstract objects. They make them the objects that they are. Their encoded properties make them the objects that they are. So encoded properties are even encoded mathematical properties are even more important to the properties than the properties that they necessarily exemplify. For example, the number 1 necessarily exemplifies the property of not being a building, not being a spoon. Right? A lot of philosophers think, well, if it's necessarily exemplified, well, it's got to be finds a good exception there. But anyway, you can't conclude that that's what its essence is in this theory, just because it necessarily exemplifies it. In fact, even the property of being abstract, which is necessarily exemplified by abstract objects, is not as essential to their identity as their encoded properties. Okay, that's an interesting result. And now it also explains the asymmetry between Socrates' properties and the unit set of Socrates. Take some simple modal set theory plus Lure elements. So that after you import that into object theory, you get that theory makes it the case that Socrates is an element of the unit set of Socrates. It makes it the case that the unit set of Socrates exemplifies the property of being such that Socrates is an element of it, and being such that Socrates exemplifies that it's an element of the unit set of Socrates. Well, the middle claim there implies that Socrates, the unit set of Socrates, encodes being such that it's Socrates is an element of it. This thing follows from this thing because of our biconditional, right, our equivalence theorem. But we can't infer anything about what properties Socrates has because the only thing that follows from this are encoding claims. And you don't get new properties out of encoding claims. There's a built-in asymmetry of the kind that Fine was trying to explain when he worked on his paper, Essence and Modality. This is something I discussed in a paper that came out in Mind in 2006, in case you're interested in pursuing it. This, and all of these issues are came up in reading some recent works on structuralism, so that's why I picked on these. Can there be cross-structural identity distinctness between objects and elements of a theory? Well, the theory actually yields the claim that the natural number 2 is distinct from the piano number 2, and it's distinct from the real number 2. The natural number 2 encodes properties like being the number of Fs. The piano number 2 doesn't encode those kind of properties. It encodes all the properties you get from the piano axioms alone. The real number 2 encodes a whole group of different properties. If the conceptions are different, the objects are different, unless you think that abstract objects are out there waiting to be discovered, which, as a Platonist, I think the burden is too great to bear. I mean, I'm somewhat sympathetic to the Platonist view, but I think it's got to be modified in order to be sustained. So it also yields distinctness claims that says one of these, the natural number 2 is distinct from the unit set of the unit set of the null set in ZF and from this set consisting of the unit of the null set and the unit set of the null set. Right? These are just theorems you get, right, from their distinctness encoding. There's no Julius Caesar problem because identity is defined. X equals Y is defined generally on an earlier slide. I didn't define the number of S equals the number of G's and only and so that it's undefined when the number of S equals Caesar. The number of S equals Caesar, just in case they're both ordinary objects and they exemplify the same properties, or they're both abstract objects and they encode the same properties, and we know, given properties of Caesar, that he's ordinary, that they're not identical. You can prove they're not identical from this theory. So when T and T prime have the same theorems, because T has a redundant axiom, for example, or they're notational variants, we collapse them. So this is one part of the answer to your question. Prior to importing them into the theory. And we can say things about the structure of piano number theory and the ZF set omega. Well, there's an isomorphism between the structural elements of piano number theory and the members of omega. Right? You can define that isomorphism in object theory because it's just a relation. I treat functions as relations. Okay, next issue. Do elements ontologically depend on their structure? Answer, well, from what I've done so far, the structure and its relations ontologically depend on each other. Why? Because they're all grounded in facts of the form, in theory T, proposition P is true. And from those facts, we've abstracted out both the structure and the elements of the structure at the same time. Right? So, and this applies to both algebraic mathematical theories and non-algebraic mathematical theories. That's just the way you treat, you understand mathematics in this framework. So our answer is therefore in conflict with a recent paper by Oystein, where he says things like a set depends on its elements in a way in which the elements don't depend on the set, the identity of a singleton doesn't depend on any other objects or on the hierarchy of sets, we can give an exhaustive account of the identity of the empty set in its singleton without ever mentioning infinite sets, no set is strongly dependent on the structure of the entire universe, etc., etc. So why is there a difference here between what he concluded and what we concluded? Well, there's a lot of reasons for this. One is Oystein's relying on Fine's notion of ontological dependence and Fine's theory of essence, and our theory of essence is very different, and the explanation of the asymmetry between Socrates and the unit set of Socrates is very different. That's one of the reasons we're getting different answers to the question. Now, Oystein also uses abstracts for isomorphism types and a Frege biconditional for offices, and I think these are problematic. He works it out in the paper the bad company objection, but we talked about this last night, and he knows that. I think you agree. There's still a little more work to be done, right?
We'll have a lot of work to do.
Okay. All right. There's still some questions to be answered by that paper. Okay. And then Linnabo's asymmetry in pure set theory, I think, gets its purchase This is not really a criticism, but I just want you to reflect on this. It gets its person from focusing on what I'll call unit set theory. Unit set theory has three axioms, the null set, extensionality, and the unit set axiom, which says for every x there's a y which has its members just x. Okay? Now, if you restrict your attention to unit set theory, of course there's no reference to large cardinals, for example, when individuating unit sets or any other set. But you might think that when you individuate any set in unit set theory, it goes by way of extensionality, and which quantifies over every set. Thus, I'd say that even the individuation of the null set and the unit set of null set in unit set theory is, in some sense, defined by quantifying over the whole structure. That's one way of looking at this that explains why there's a difference. I actually think what's really going on here is this asymmetry just coming about that some people think that a set depends on its elements in a way that the elements don't depend on the set just comes from the fact that the membership relation is asymmetric. And that's really all that's going on that justifies, that grounds that intuition. But in any case, on our view, in full ZF, the individuation of both the null set and the unit set of the null set references, in some sense, by the whole structure. Right? That's how it works in this theory. Do elements of a structure have hexaedies? Answer, no. And the reason is, identity simpliciter is defined in terms of encoding formulas. Right? These are not well defined. And here's why. Abstract objects. Now, I'm going to step into set theory for a minute. I've not quantified over sets. I've not taken sets as primitive. I haven't taken any mathematical primitives so far. But for the mathematicians among you, you may want to know, is this theory consistent? And the way to do that is to look at, for a model in set theory. And I'm going to take set theory as given just for the purposes of giving you a model. So you can model abstract objects in set theory as sets of properties. But when you do that, you can't then take for each distinct set of properties and create a property of being identical to that set, a new property that's in the set of properties that becomes the elements of those sets of properties. Because that would give you a one-to-one correspondence from the power set of the set of properties into a subset of the set of properties in violation of Cantor's theorem. That's why there are no hexaedies for abstract objects. You can't make a new, in fact, for any relation R, you can't build a new property of bearing R to A that's distinct for each abstract object A. And so that has an interesting consequence, because if you define this a new identity relation, ordinary identity, which is perfectly well behaved, that is, X and Y are ordinarily identical just in case they exemplify the same properties. This is a well-defined lambda expression. It doesn't have any encoding formulas. And it's well behaved on the ordinary objects. Why? Well, you have distinct abstract, distinct ordinary objects, and the property of being identical to that ordinary object will be distinct. But for it's not well behaved on the abstract objects, because you can prove that for any relation R, there's an abstract object A and B, A not equal to B, that means they encode different properties, but this property is identical to this property, and by letting R be this relation here, you can prove that there are distinct abstract objects A and B which are indiscernible. The theory generates indiscernible abstract objects. And in that sense, it's got something in common with some facts from modern physics. That is, objects that are distinct because they encode different properties, but they're indiscernible with respect to the properties that they exemplify, because there's too many of them for our old notion of exemplification to keep separate. So, Octavio Bueno has been pushing me to work on this to see whether we can apply this to understanding some facts in modern physics. And as soon as in the next opportunity, I promised him we will work on this together. And we might do that by relaxing that principle I had earlier that said ordinary objects don't encode properties. But in any case, you get this indiscernibility. And if you'd like to actually see the axial model that gives you a consistency, ask me in the question period, and I'll produce that. Now, we started a few minutes late, and so I still have about 3 or 4 minutes, but I'm going to, I think I might be able to finish even within my allotted time. There's one last issue, and it takes several slides, 3 slides, maybe 4 slides to handle. Does indiscernibility pose a problem for structuralism? Now, we talked about indiscernible abstract objects, but that's not the kind of indiscernibility we're worried about in mathematics. In mathematics, we're worried about mathematical theories, at least for a structuralist, which have all these indiscernible mathematical objects. Okay? Now, how does object theory treat them? Well, I say it doesn't produce a problem because, and here, let me do it by way of an example. Consider the theory of dense linear orderings with no endpoints. Or you might take the theory of the Euclidean plane or something. It doesn't matter. Lots of indiscernible objects. These are the axioms, right? Transitivity, irreflexivity, connectedness of this relation. It's got to be dense. There's no endpoints. So aren't all the elements of this structure indiscernible? The answer is no. And the reason is there are no elements of that structure. The structure is defined solely by general properties of the ordering relation, this relation here, which encodes such properties as being an R, which is such that R is not reflexive, being an R such that R is transitive, being an R such that all these other axioms hold. And that's all you get out of this theory. Right? You just get properties of the structuring relation. You don't get indiscernible objects because they're just, by definition, I'll show you the definition as we move to another example. There's nothing to instantiate for that definition X is an element of the structure. Because remember, the definition said that the structure's got to make it true that for any distinct object Y, there's a property that discerns the two. So to get your intuitions going on this, think about what happens when you do fiction. A novel asserts, General X advanced upon Moscow with an army of 100,000 men. There aren't 100,002 characters just introduced by that statement. Only three, namely the general, Moscow, and the army of 100,000 men. But you don't have 100,000 distinct new characters. This is the way thought and language works, at least according to this picture. And I'm not sure I know of another clear picture that gives you 100,000 distinct characters out of this. You might get 100,000 discernible characters if you've got a theory of indiscernibility, but that remains to be seen. I, at this point, get an army, and I get the advance upon relation as having a certain property. So then, the model theoretic, here's what I want you not to do. I want you to distinguish your model theoretic notion of what it is to be an object of the theory, and that's namely the value of a bound variable, from the object theoretic notion of element of a structure that I've defined. I don't think it's legitimate for you to appeal to the former, use your intuitions here, because model theory is part of the problem to be explained. Model theory is just more mathematics, and we need to be able to explain the facts about model theory in the same way we're trying to give a structuralist account about set theory, and because set model theory is just a kind of applied set theory. So I'm trying to give a definition of element of a structure that doesn't appeal to mathematical notions like the model theoretic notion of object of theory. So here's another example, the one I'll stop with because there are several slides. So this is the famous case, I and minus I. To get the complex numbers, take the axioms for the real number theory and you add this claim, I squared equals minus 1. Strictly speaking, as I would do it, you index the identity relation to the theory of complex numbers. Here's the objection you might want to raise. The structural elements I and minus I are collapsed in our structuralism. Why? Here's the way you might reason. Well, any formula phi with only x free in the language of complex analysis holds of I, also is going to hold of minus I. And vice versa. Thus, I and the minus I are indiscernible. And after importing C into object theory, we get, that is, C makes I holds F, I has F true if and only if C makes minus I has F true. One might then continue to argue by the equivalence theorem that since I encodes F if and only if I exemplifies F and C, and minus I encodes F if and only if minus I encodes F and C, exemplifies F and C, then it would follow that I encodes F if and only if minus I encodes F. And now we've got I equals minus I by the definition of identity for abstract objects. Right? giving you the objection. It's as clear an objection as you can make it. It's stated in terms that you can all see how the objection goes. The answer is equally clear. The argument's blocked because I and minus I are not elements of the structure C. So, whoops, I got three slides at once. Oops, I must have done something wrong. So here's the procedure that I want you to adopt. Import phi into T into object theory by, remember, we're going to add to phi star, which is the result of replacing all the well-defined singular terms by their indexed version. So now the definition X is an element of structure C is to say that C makes it the case that for anything Y which is distinct from X, there's a property that distinguishes them. By this definition, I and minus I aren't elements of C. And so our procedure for interpreting C, so the problem is to interpret the language of the mathematicians is, before you import C, replace every theorem of the form phi that has I in it by a theorem of the form there is an X such that X squared plus 1 equals 0 and phi holds of X. And from that, you import the result, and under this analysis, I and minus I disappear, and we're left with just structural properties of complex addition and complex multiplication. For example, for complex addition, for each theorem, we can abstract out properties of this form. There's a property of this relate being an R such that this holds, right? X squared R1 equals 0. That's a property of the relation of complex addition that follows from this. So the last slide is, well, so now what gives its mathematical structure its structure? Most everybody agrees it's the relations. And without the relations, there's no structure. An element of the structure, we claim, has to be uniquely characterizable in terms of the relations of the structure. It's got to be discernible. Indiscernibles arise from symmetries, non-trivial automorphisms of the structure. Mathematicians working with a structure find it useful to give separate names, arbitrary names, to indiscernibles, but these names don't denote elements of the structure, is what we're arguing. After all, the names are arbitrary, and there's nothing, no property that is. Your handout says relation, but I've changed that on the slide to no property because I was worried that someone might use the weak indiscernibility that James had in his paper. But there's no property within the theory that distinguishes the indiscernibles from one another. The mathematician's use of I and minus I and C is very different from their use of 1 and minus 1. The naming of 1 and minus 1 is not arbitrary. You can't permute them and retain the same structure. So it makes sense to say that these terms, I and minus I, don't denote objects in the way that the terms 1 and minus 1 denote objects. Basically, we're saying they're not elements of the structure, they're symmetries, and end up becoming properties of the relations in that structure. And that's how, that gives us the foundations for structuralism. That's precise, and now open to your objections. Thank you very much.